I wonder, what are you afraid of? For some, our immediate answer to that question might be a fairly minor fear, something that's easily avoided and doesn't have too much of a detrimental impact on our life. Fear of spiders, a mild fear of the dark or of heights. For others, of course, fears and phobias can present far bigger problems that can cast a shadow over the whole of someone's life. Most obviously things like agoraphobia, fear of going out of the house, or a severe aversion to dirt. These things are a reminder that what we're afraid of can have a major impact on an individual's life. And not just for those with an identifiable psychological problem that requires treatment either. And not only in a negative sense, actually, but positively too. In the Old Testament, fear of God is seen not as a bad thing, but as the foundation of a well-lived life. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, appears both in Proverbs and the Psalms. And the New Testament, on several occasions too, encourages us to make sure that when we're making any moral decision, we think very carefully about whose reaction we're afraid of. That we fear what God thinks about us far more than we fear what other people might think. Jesus himself, earlier on in Luke's Gospel, commanded his followers, chapter 12, "I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more, but I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who, after the killing of the body, has power to throw you into hell." In other words, fear God's verdict on Final Judgment Day more than you fear man's verdict. Even the worst of persecutors can only have control over our earthly life, whereas God's verdict on us will affect our entire eternal destiny. And one way of thinking about our gospel reading, the parable of the miners, is to see it as raising a closely related question. Make sure what you do for God isn't limited by a fear of failure, but that you make the very most of all the gifts and opportunities that he gives. The parable begins with a man preparing to go on a journey. He's clearly a wealthy man, with much money at his disposal and at least 10 servants in his permanent employ. And so for the period of his absence, he entrusts his wealth to 10 of that retinue, one mina each. You might at this point immediately think, when you see mina, that means talent. But Luke's gospel doesn't mention talents, and actually, though in a similar parable in Matthew's gospel, it does mention that word. When the story was first written, talents had nothing to do with an ability at sport or music or anything like that. A talent was simply the name of the largest denomination coin. And a mina, similarly, is just a unit of currency. Quite a large one, a labourer's wage for 3 months, so £4,000 or £5,000 in today's values. So the servants were given the money and were told explicitly to trade it with it in the master's absence, to engage it in some kind of business, buying and selling with the hope of increasing the value of the investment that had been entrusted to them. Not that that would be easy. We're told in the version of the parable reported by Luke that the servants were doing their master's business operating in a very hostile environment. I talked about the man who'd entrusted the money to them being wealthy. Well, more than that, it appears he was something akin to the lord of the manor in those parts. Because when he went on his journey, the message was sent, "Actually, we're pleased you're gone, and we don't much like you being in charge of us anyway." And when the master returned, as in time he did, well, unsurprisingly, he wanted to know how his servants had done with all that he'd given them. We're not told how the reporting back went with all 10 of them, but only 3. And with the first two, whose reports to the master are included in Jesus' story, it was a similar tale of a big success. The first servant, single mina, had somehow produced 10 more. He had been very successful at his trading. Most of what I know about business is learned secondhand from the media, and especially from Dragon's Den. Any other fans? The big success over several series is a man called Levi Roots, who produced Reggae Reggae Sauce that you can see in pretty much every supermarket. I'm not sure of the numbers, but he's repaid the Dragon's investment in him several times over. And that's how it was with the first servant in the parable. The second servant hadn't done quite so well, but still had a pretty impressive result to come back with. He produced 5 times the original investment. And needless to say, when the master returned, he was very pleased with those first 2 men. Not only had they each got a very decent return on their capital, they brought all the profits back to him, and he was now far richer than he had been before he went away. And so he commends both of them. Well done, good servant. Because you've been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority. Well, in the first case, over 10 cities. In the second case, 5 cities. In other words, he's going to rely on those 2 servants even more in the future. And then the third servant is summoned. And to his credit, he doesn't return empty-handed. The mina of money he'd been entrusted with is still intact. And he explains to his masters, "Lord, here is your mina, which I kept away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you're a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow." Now, given what Jesus and the other Bible writers say about fear of God being a right motive, we might have expected the parable to continue with some kind of moderate commendation from the master, albeit in not quite such enthusiastic tones as that used for the first two. But after all, the money had been returned intact. Jesus ends the story, though, in a rather shocking way. The master lays into his third servant, "I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank, and at my coming I might have collected it with interest?" And he said to those who stood by, "Take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas. A parable told not, of course, to tell any nobleman listening how they ought to treat their servants, nor even to describe how rich men of the day might have been likely to behave to their household, but rather to tell us what God is like and what he expects of us, his servants. On the one hand, there's the encouragement that God will delight to reward those who are good stewards of whatever he gives to us. The innate abilities we're born with, the education and training that come our way, the abilities that we develop, the opportunities that arise in our lives. These things are all given to us ultimately by God. And if we use them well in his service, he will not only take delight in us, but reward us too. On the other hand, the rather stronger note in this parable that Jesus chooses to tell is one of warning, that if we neglect to use the gifts and opportunities we're given, God will not be pleased. The story is told of a lady who has a talking dog. So she brings it to see a talent scout. "Here, see," she says, "watch my dog talk." Then she turns and asks the dog, "What's my name?" "Ruth," the dog replies. The name was correct, but the talent scout thought, well, all dogs can say Ruth, and so he asked for a second question. "What does sandpaper feel like?" Don't you ask? Ruff, the dog answers. The scout is understandably still unimpressed. He says, you can have one more chance to impress me. What's on the top of a house? The owner asks. Roof, the dog replies. The scout has seen enough and he kicks them out. Then as they reach the street, the dog turns to his owner and says, curses, I wasn't sure whether to answer roof or chimney. And many of us waste the opportunities that are given to us in a similar way. We fail to display to the full, to exercise to the full, the gifts given to us. Why is that? Well, there are all kinds of possibilities, but as I said at the beginning, the fear of failure seems to be the problem that Jesus is highlighting in this particular parable. The third servant had, of course, been dead right to fear his master. Where he'd been wrong was in drawing the conclusion that safety first was the wisest course. For the master would have been perfectly capable of burying the mina himself. No, he'd entrusted it to the servant for him to put it to good use, to invest in some way. At the very least, the man could have taken the trouble to find a trustworthy banker who'd have returned the money with some interest. Jesus doesn't, of course, explicitly tell us how the master might have reacted had the servant invested the money in an enterprise which failed. I guess it would depend on how reckless he'd been with his master's money. But the implication is that to do nothing is even worse. For whilst we may not be able to control whether we're a success or a failure in any enterprise, we are responsible for the question of whether we make an attempt to use the gifts and opportunities we've been given by God. Important words maybe for some as individuals, if we're held back from using our gifts and the openings that come our way by fear of failure. We're being warned simply to bury our talents leaves us without even the slimmest possibility of pleasing the Lord. There's been some interesting studies done recently comparing British attitudes to enterprise and risk with that of the Americans. And it turns out they are almost twice as likely as we are to be involved in running their own business. Now, of course, enterprise can be motivated by greed, and it's perfectly possible to be an employee on a regular wage and to live a life that's pleasing to God. But if our national trait is to be rather risk-averse in the work we choose, that does warn us we may have the same attitude in other areas of our lives. Maybe that explains why American church life, despite its many faults and failings, is so much healthier than ours. Because, of course, as well as an encouragement for individuals to be using their gifts, and a warning against the kind of safety-first attitude that prefers not to try something rather than be left with egg on our face. Well, as well as that working at an individual level, so the same lesson is there for our church life. We thank God for those who 80 years ago and then 60 years ago decided that they needed to do what they could to provide church buildings in this area of what was then new housing. Sometimes people attempting that kind of project don't succeed. Maybe the extra funds aren't given, the permission isn't forthcoming. We thank God, though, for our forebears' efforts in that regard. And it's my conviction that similar enterprise risks might well be taken now to make sure that our buildings, and especially our current hall facilities, are suitable for our church's mission now and for future generations. Do pray for our PCC as it's due to decide tomorrow whether to pursue the plan for a replacement hall adjacent to the church that the Building Development Committee and I are recommending. That same encouragement to move past being unduly risk averse is what Lichfield Diocese have been trying to communicate in recent years with their requirement that each parish should draw up a mission action plan. The implication beforehand had sometimes been drawn that if a church maintained its regular worship and paid its way, well, all as well was as far as the diocese was concerned. But that kind of approach can be dangerously similar to burying your talent in the ground. For Jesus, if his people are to be faithful to him, some kind of enterprise or even risk-taking is to be the norm. I might add that, to my mind, well-meaning Christians sometimes evoke the principle, if something is from God, it will succeed, rather too glibly, to me anyway. The implication seems to be, when people say that, is that God will usually give us direct instructions as to what course of action to take, if only we'll listen to those direct instructions, and if we follow them, there's pretty much no risk of failure. That kind of attitude can sound spiritual, and it's certainly meant to inspire action. In fact, I think it's unrealistic and can lead to an excessive fear of failure. For on that way of thinking, to fail proves that you've either failed to hear God or worse, been disobedient to him. The reality, though, is that just as the master in the parable isn't pictured as telling his servant exactly what they should do with the mina of money entrusted to them, well, so God doesn't normally tell us exactly what we should do in any circumstance. At least in many, it's not quite clear. Rather, he gives us gifts and abilities, and he sends opportunities. He invites us to be enterprising. An individual may consider different possible paths. We may pray to God for wisdom before making a decision as to what course to follow. A church may have to weigh carefully different opinions that are put forward before deciding on a plan and then going for it. Maybe sometimes it will be a glorious success. At other times, of course, it may appear to us to achieve very little, but there'll be glimmers of God's providence in using it to achieve a different purpose, maybe even a greater purpose. At other times, if we're honest, even to say that will seem to be clutching at straws. But what we will be able to say, both as individuals and as a church, when we face our Master on Judgment Day, is that we have at least sought to do something, that we haven't just buried our gifts, opportunities he gave to us in the ground, but have used them in his service. Amen. Please stand for the creed.